23rd of October, 2019, VIHE in Vrindavan. We're looking at Canto 6, Chapter 17, verses 16 through 24. As we said this morning, the theme here is responding to difficulty put upon us, responding to people who are aggressive. So we looked this morning at trying to understand the motives that we have when we criticize others and when we should and should not criticize others. So here we see that after he got this curse, the Chitraketu offered his obeisances to Shiva and Parvati, accepted the curse. He said, "You're qualified to give out the curse." And then he got philosophical. He described the workings of material nature. And he described the attitude of the Lord and the devotee towards happiness and distress. And then he said, "I didn't do anything wrong, but I'm willing to accept your curse." Okay, so we're going to look at Chitraketu's physical actions. We're going to look at his mental actions, his physical activities, his mental activities, his statements of philosophy, his philosophical preaching, and then we're going to ask, who caused the cursing of Chitraketu? Who is the villain of this story? Who is responsible for the cursing of Chitraketu? And hopefully we'll have time to have a bit of a debate. All right, what were Chitraketu's physical actions? Yes?
He bows down.
What else?
Descended from the airplane.
Got off his airplane. And one more?
Folded his hands.
It says he gave pleasure to Parvati. So he did physical actions of what? All those are physical signs of
humility.
So we have the word vandanam as one of the nine processes of devotion. And vandanam means both what?
Prayer
and obeisances. So vandanam means a physical prayer with your body, and it also means a prayer with your words. So, first thing Chitraketu does is with his body. Why does that matter?
Why does it matter?
Because whatever is in your mind is depicted in your body language.
Okay. Why else?
It's showing the other person.
Okay. Any other reasons?
It helps.
Yeah, go ahead. Yes?
In order to basically.
But why physical? Why doesn't he just stay in his airplane and just say what he's going to say? But why physical?
Because it demonstrates openly an attitude of submission, accept something.
Okay, so there it shows. You were saying it shows or it demonstrates. You know, I can say I'm humble, but what I demonstrate. So they say that 70% of communication is what we do physically. If I say, "Oh, sure, I have plenty of time to talk to you. Yeah, I'd love to talk to you. Sure, what do you have to say anyway? Do you believe me?" No. So, by the way, the fact that communication is 70% body language and about 23% tone of voice and only 7% words is why communication is so much better when we're physically with somebody. I'd like you to pay attention next time that you're talking to somebody on the phone. This is a little homework assignment. Next time you're talking to someone on the phone, pay attention to what happens with your mind. And then pay attention to the difference between that and when you're talking to someone face to face. You'll find that when you're talking to someone on the phone, you have to concentrate more on what they're saying. And that's not because you can't hear them as well. That's not why. It's because you can't see them. And what happens when we talk to somebody we can't see is our mind imagines what they're doing. Because we actually cannot understand somebody without body language. So our mind imagines what the other person's body language is. Which is one reason why we can misunderstand people more on the phone. If it's in writing, our mind has to imagine their body language and their tone of voice. Which is why there's even more scope for misunderstanding in a written communication. And that's what we do. And pay attention to that. When you're reading something someone wrote, pay attention to what your mind is doing, and you'll see that your mind is imagining that the person is speaking in a particular tone of voice. So this is why it's much more dangerous to drive a car when you're talking to someone on the phone than if you're talking to somebody in the car. Because it requires a lot more mental concentration to have a conversation with someone on the phone. So pay attention to this in the next few days. Notice the difference when you're talking to somebody in person, when you're talking to someone on the phone, and when you're communicating in writing, and how much mental energy and what kind of mental energy is required to have that conversation. So there's a lot of studies done on body language. I mean, if I were to say, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. You know, I mean, you can curse me if you want. It's okay. I don't care if you curse me. I can go to heaven or hell. Doesn't matter. Am I humble?
No.
No, but I'm saying the same words. Or even if I had a nice tone of voice. Yeah, heaven or hell doesn't matter, you know? It just doesn't matter. The devotees are satisfied with anything. You wouldn't believe me. And you notice that you're giving priority to my body language. Did you all notice that?
Yes.
When there was a misfit, when my words and tone of voice and body language didn't match, you believed my body language and my tone of voice over my words. And when my words and my tone of voice both matched, but my body language didn't, you believed my body language. Correct? Right? So we put much more stress on what someone does physically than what they do verbally.
Can we also say that the mind can, like, you can say something different, but your body tells you the truth?
The body more tends to tell the truth. Of course, you know, actors learn how to control their body language so that they're believable. The art of acting is the art of lying. You know, the actor has to get their words, their tone of voice, and their body language to all give the same message, even though it's not theirs. They have to really get into the character and get the body language of the character as well. And people who are very expert at lying deliberately control their body language. Now, it's debatable whether you can do that 100%. So there are people who study what they call micro movements, and they claim that they can read very small, unconscious physical movements. But this it's a debated science. It's not. It's a science that taught to police officers and detectives and interrogators, but there's still debate about how valid it is. How valid is it that, you know, this particular muscle twitch right here means this? And also, in different cultures, body language can mean different things. So there is some cultural difference between with what body language means. Just like this cultural difference between what words mean. And I'm not talking about the language itself. It's just like in some cultures when you say no, you mean no. And in some cultures when you say no, you mean maybe. There are some cultures where it's very, very, very rude to say no. So you don't say, you have other ways of saying no. Like I was once at a meeting with some British devotees, and I asked one of them a question, and he gives this 5-minute answer. And I look at him and I say, "Are you saying no?" I was very confused. And he felt offended that I was making it obvious. He wanted to say no without saying no. So there's also a lot of cultural differences between what people mean by what they say and how they communicate. And some of these things are opposite. So it's a show of pride in one culture is a show of humility in another. And that's also something that has to be taken into account. I mean, a very simple example. There was a friend of mine from South America who married a man from Fiji. And when they would do programs at their house, they were in the United States. So she was from South America, he was from Fiji, they were living in America. And they would have programs at their house, and the devotees would offer to help clean after the program. And the man would always get very offended whenever anybody would offer to help clean. He said, you know, it was an offense for the guests to help the host to clean. But in America, that was a very common thing to do. So what was taken as a sign of respect by the Americans was taken as a sign of offense by him. So these sorts of things, or Hari Vilas tells a very funny story that his family was from Armenia and they moved to the United States, and their neighbor invited them over for dinner. So they come to the neighbor's house and they're sitting on the couch, on the sofa and on the chairs. And so the Americans are saying, "Dinner is ready, please come and eat." And the Armenians say, "No, no, no, we're not hungry." No, they're coming for dinner, you know. And then the Americans say, "Again, please come eat, everything's ready." And the Armenians say, "No, no, no, we're not hungry." And so the Americans shrug their shoulders and they sit down and they have dinner without their guests. So, you know, there are different meanings of body language, and these things are very deep rooted in a culture. The evidence is that it takes at least 100 to 200 years for people to change these sort of cultural patterns. And this fact of cultural differences is something that is, I believe, a real problem in a Hare Krishna movement. It's one we don't recognize very well. But there are very real cultural differences between how we understand behavior, what we understand to be respect, and what we understand to be offensive. Another very famous story is that in Sweden, they had no ruler, and so they asked a king or a prince in France to come and be the king in Sweden. So this French prince had studied Swedish in preparation for becoming the king of Sweden. And when he came to address the legislature, he spoke in Swedish, but his Swedish wasn't very good. And so the members of the legislature started to laugh, and he never spoke in Swedish again. But with the Swedes, they have a much more casual attitude between authorities and subordinates. In France, they have more distance. It's more reverential. So in France, they're much more reverential to their authorities, and in Sweden, they much more treat their authorities like equals. So it was a very difficult cultural difference. Some of these cultural differences happen depending on the distance from the equator. Nobody knows why. Some of them happen according to population density. Some of them happen according to national wealth. So So these are interesting things, but it takes many, many generations to change a person's cultural understanding, because it's something we learn when we're like 1 and 2 years old. But we do see that this sort of submission that Chitraketu is doing physically, we do see also some parallels within the animal kingdom. So if one animal submits to another, what do they generally do? They bow down. What else do they do?
The dogs bring their tail down.
They put their tail down.
They may whimper.
They may whimper. What else do they do?
Smell each other.
Well, that they do all the time. but when it, if an animal is surrendering, the surrendering animal, if animals are having a fight and one of them surrenders, or if they want to avoid a fight and one of them surrenders, what else do they do?
They lie down.
They lie down, yes, we said
their ears move down.
Sometimes they move their ears, yeah. They'll often lie on their back. Why do they lie on their back?
Because they're showing their belly.
They're showing the belly that they could be attacked. They're basically allowing the other party to attack them. And when you're lying on your back, can you attack very well? No. So when they lie on their back, it shows that they're not in a position to attack. Yeah, so they'll lie on their back, they fall on the ground, they'll go backwards.
Surrender.
What?
Surrender.
They're doing some physical sign of surrender. Sometimes they'll move their ears. So we have also some basic, even regarding different cultures, we have some basic bodily signals of I surrender and I accept you as an authority. There was, I can't remember his name, and I don't even remember the name of the book, but it was one of those books that really, it really affected me. It was this man whose father trained horses. And his father would capture wild horses and tame them and then sell them. And he would treat the horses very cruelly. He would put like a bag over their head and beat them and starve them. And this way he would tame them. So this one man, he was a boy. One of his jobs was to go out and capture the wild horses for his father. His father was a cruel man to his family also. He was just a cruel man. But that was the way that people were taming horses in general in the world. And this young man, he was a boy, he would watch the horses in the wild that he would be capturing to bring home for his family. And he had a medical condition where he couldn't see colors at all. So many people cannot see red and green, but they can see other colors. But he couldn't see any colors. For him, the world was just black and white. But by only seeing black and white, he would focus on details that other people couldn't see. And he would watch these wild horses, and the horses were in herds run by a chief female. And he would watch how the chief female would train the other horses to be submissive to her. And he would watch that she would give out physical signals that you did something wrong, you're in trouble, and how the horse that was being criticized, the horse that was being corrected, would be pushed out of the herd physically, and then how it would have to come back in, and how it would have to signal with its head and its ears and its body and its tail, I'm sorry. And how then the chief matriarch would communicate physically, you're forgiven, you can come back in. I think it was called The Man Who Talks to Horses or something. And I can't remember the name of the book. It was at my father's house, and I read it, and I thought, oh my God, what a book. And then he took this technique, and he acted like he was the chief female horse. And he would take these wild horses, and he would copy the behavior of the chief female horse in his own body. And he was able to train wild horses in half an hour with no violence at all. And his father hated him for it. His father was so angry that his son showed that his cruelty was unnecessary, that he beat his son so badly that the son had to be hospitalized, and he hardly even talked to his son for the rest of his son's life. But the boy grew up to become very, very famous. He had a lot of physical problems from his father beating him, but he became very famous. He traveled all over the world, and he changed the way that horses were tamed and horses were trained. But he did it all through this body language from the wild animals, of you just like, you turn your back, and then you turn this way, you look this way, you know, very subtle. And it was so subtle that people watching him doing it wouldn't see what he was doing. You know, they wouldn't believe it. And so they would test him, they would bring him, you know, the wildest, craziest horses. And they say, oh, you brought your own horse or whatever. He demonstrated in front of the Queen of England and so many things. But my point is that there is a language with physicality. And so physicality matters, what we do. I mean, this was what Daksha objected to, that Lord Shiva didn't stand up, right? So these things matter. And we are communicating something with what we do physically. So Chitraketu, he got off his airplane. Why is getting off his airplane significant?
Certainly he'll be proud of his airplane.
Okay, because he's proud of his airplane.
It gives him position of
height.
Height above.
Yes, it literally put him above. So keep this in mind too, that there's a certain symbolism in what we do physically. Where people sit, how high they sit, how they sit in relation to others, or how they stand, and there's some symbolism there, as one devotee was recently, Ramatirtha was recently saying in a meeting, it's the optics. What does it look like? So there's communication, there's symbolic communication. So he keeps going low, right? He gets off the airplane, he bows his head, but when you fold your hands, you can't attack, yes? Okay, so this is physical. Okay, now we're going to go on to his mentality. So he accepts this curse. What enables him to accept this curse? How is he able to do this? Do you think this was easy? Would it be easy? If someone cursed you to be a demon, would you just be like, oh cool, that's fine? I don't think so. And especially if we were a demigod, you know, traveling around the universe in our airplane and having everybody praise us. I don't think we'd just say, sure, that's fine, whatever you want. Maybe we can think for a minute, have we been in any kind of situation in our life where we were put to a lower position? Where maybe we were in charge of something and then we were told, I don't want you to be in charge anymore, or we were part of a group and we were taken off the group, or we had some title and we'd had it taken away, or even we had some service. Maybe it was a simple service. Maybe we had the service of making the garlands or sweeping the floor and someone came and said, I don't want you to do this anymore. You messed up. Can we think of a time like that? Just personally, you don't have to talk about it, but if you just think of a time like that and how we felt, what was our inner state? Especially if it was something that we really liked. Okay, so we have, Prabhupada talks about that the subtle body has thinking, feeling, and willing, or thoughts, emotions, and behaviors. So we just spent about 15-20 minutes talking about Chitraketu's behaviors. By the way, when you act humbly with your body, does that help change your mentality? So it's not just a signal to the other person. Yeah. Let's try that. Let's all stand up. Let's all stand up and let's look at Srila Prabhupada. Let's do a little experiment here. If you can come up in front of your desks so there's nothing in front of you. And let's try telling Srila Prabhupada that we surrender to him while taking a very aggressive physical stance. So try putting your feet apart, folding your arms, putting your head, your chin, tuck your chin in back, and then say, Prabhupada, I surrender to you.
Prabhupada, I surrender to you.
Okay, now let's try offering obeisances and say, Prabhupada, I surrender.
Prabhupada, I surrender.
Did you feel a difference?
Yes.
Yeah. How big of a difference was that?
Like day and night.
It was like day and night, wasn't it? So one of the things that helped Chitraketu's mentality was what he did with his body. All right, now what I'd like us to do... is, could you two work together? And... you two could work together. We're going to have lavender today. And... oh, you have that? Okay, all right. Use that. You three... okay, I'd like us to make a list of, we have here thinking and feeling. So we've done the physical. Now we're going to look at the thoughts and the emotions. So if you could make two columns. In one column, if you could write down Chitraketu's emotions and give at least verse numbers. And then another column, his thoughts, and also give verse numbers. And you can just write a few words for each. You don't have to write like a whole sentence. Okay, so we're going to take about... probably we'll take about 10 to 15 minutes for this. Okay, so thoughts and emotions. What's Chitraketu's emotions? And what's Chitraketu's thoughts? And for each one, you should have a verse number to substantiate where you're getting that from. Okay, so if each group could please explain, and then we'll see what we came up with. Let's start with this one.
He was not angry, even though he was cursed. You know that maybe this curse will be a blessing for him to go back home quickly. And text 21 says, his thoughts was, he glorified the Lord, that the Lord is neutral. The Lord is a friend to everybody, pure and devoted, and the devoted. God is neutral. And it's because of blessings from high authority, it's mercy of the Lord. The Lord always becomes merciful. Either he kill you or he chastises you, it's mercy. And that is the potency of the Lord. That is the meaning of that. That means, well, Baba Tiyan to correct her because you see her as a son. You have to correct her. Him. Then, emotion, analytical unfairness. Krishna is unfair to those who are not surrendered to him. But when you are a devotee of Krishna, he's always in your silence. In that side, he's unfair. And if you come to the thoughts, 24, he was honoring Parvati that, oh, you are my mother. If you curse me, it's like a blessing. So I'm not worried. And he was surrounded in faith that I have faith in the Supreme God. Everything that happens is being planned by God. That was his thoughts. And emotion, he was pacifying Mother Parvati for causing him. That cause will make him go faster. If like a blessing, he will stay for long on earth. But when he curses him, he will become a demon. At that time, he will be liberated very fast.
Thank you. Okay, let's take the bottom one there in green. No, you can sit down.
Such the kind of duality, and he tells all these dualities are impermanent. the emotional, if this everything is impermanent. And in text 23, he says, although like everything happens, it is because of the will of the Lord. And without the will of Lord, nothing takes place. Either one is favored by something or one is not favored by the material world. It's everything the will of Lord. So what the emotion he feels is the Lord's material potency is creating all kinds of causes to the living entity. And in text 24, he feels that his thought is that Mother Parvati has become unnecessarily angry, and he tells that, but since all this happened due to the, although I won't have said not wrong, please let whatever you think is wrong to be pardoned. And he's properly understanding that neither it was his mistake nor her mistake. So the emotion is that he properly understands what happened. What he thought it was, she was little unnecessarily angry on him.
Thank you. Okay, so whichever one is at the top there.
Okay, I think I forgot to write the emotions.
Oh, well, but that's actually a very important part of a person's mentality.
But I know what it could relate to, but I
think okay, so you put emotions at the top, but you didn't actually write any.
Not very well, I mean, too.
Okay.
But here...
There's some.
Okay. So, in text 17, I don't know why I don't write 16, sorry. 17, he accepts this curse, and he's saying it's past because of his past deeds. And he's saying, like, his emotion is, I don't mind, that means he's accepting.
Yeah, accepting is an emotion. Yeah.
And then verse 18, because he again sees the cause... Why it is the past misdeeds? It is because he was in ignorance, and the living entities go come. They have happiness or distress. It's also because of the ignorance. And then now he's not blaming himself, but he's saying he is not the doer, but the doer is the ignorance. And verse 19, he sees. What was that? And verse 19, the living entity is again with the gross ignorance, and he sees the acceptance because it is under the Supreme Personality of God. And verse 20, he sees different waves, the duality, curse and favor, and the advantage, happiness and distress. And he sees Krishna as a controller. So that like he's accepting the silent. I mean, accepting even Lord's supremacy. And then 21, he says that the difference between happiness and distress is only by people who are in sattva-guna and raja-guna. But then he understands, he has an understanding that the Supreme Lord is transcendental. That's why he doesn't have happiness and distress. And because he is also transcendental and situated, he is like neutral. And then verse 22, Supreme Lord is neutral to happiness and distress. And because he is also connected, he didn't mind the curse. So this is again, the acceptance is fallen. And verse 23, Supreme Lord creates happiness and distress, good fortune and bad fortune, birth and liberation, bondage and liberation, to continue the cycle of material existence. Now he has taken the position of neutral because he properly understood the Lord and how material world is coming. And I have from verse 24, again, because of past mistakes, I'm in this position, and he's humble and asking for forgiveness for any kind of mistakes.
Okay, thank you. This one over here.
I was blank. Used to.
Just one of you get up, I don't care who it is.
Okay, so happiness and distress results from one's own deeds or karma. That's with it along the mind, being cursed because it's anyway happening. And then neither you nor I can be blamed. I find that's quite amazing. He's says, okay, not me, he followed, but also not you. So it means he didn't felt angry or why is this lady cursing me? Okay, you're just an instrument. What is good or what is bad? Like, this, there was this focus on what actually should, what is happening, this was. So the feeling of detachment from the material world, like this ego goes detached. And we felt that was the basic feeling throughout all these shlokas, because it was just because of very thoughts. Yeah, like the conditions always contaminated by the material energy, by the gunas. The glories of Krishna were described, and although he's actually completely detached from what's going on, still it is he through the energies who actually creates five activities. But yeah, he felt always detached.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, I think you got everything that I had gotten, but this feeling of peace. When you say no anger, that isn't really an emotion. The emotion would be like peace or acceptance. We have a lot of acceptance here. So acceptance is an emotion. It's interesting, humility isn't actually an emotion. But feelings of acceptance, feeling of detachment, feelings of peace, those are all emotions. Yes?
I have a little doubt, because in text 24, he says that although what I have said is not wrong, please let whatever you think is wrong be part of it.
Yes.
It seems to be a little bit like not so wrong, because that's the typical kind
That's the typical thing. I'm so glad you brought this up.
The condition source is...
That's the typical thing that people who study apologies say never to do. So I've read a number of in-depth study of how to apologize. And one of the biggest mistakes is to say, I'm sorry if you feel offended.
Yeah, because actually I've not done
anything wrong. I've not done anything wrong, and I'm sorry if you feel offended. In fact, it's a little condescending. You know what condescending means?
Yes.
Yeah?
I'm really saying sorry.
It's not really saying sorry. I mean, it's interesting. Prabhupada said, as a matter of course, Maharaj Chitraketu begged pardon. So we have two possibilities here. One possibility. Oh, I thought we weren't going to see you this afternoon at all. I hope that means everything is okay.
Yes.
Okay. So one possibility is that Chitraketu is on such a level of spiritual consciousness that he just isn't seeing the world the way we conditioned souls see the world. He's just not seeing the world in terms of good and bad, right and wrong. You know, he just sees, I'm a soul, I have nothing to do with this world. Whatever is going on with this world is just... it's just an illusion, and so there's no question of my doing something wrong or you're doing something wrong. And so he's apologizing out of etiquette, but it's not that he feels some sort of repentance or shame in a material sense. And for a transcendent, for someone who's just neutral to material emotions, that might be completely fine. The other possibility is that he still has some pride, which is going to be finished as Vitrasura. So there's one of those two, and we don't have any indication from our acharyas which that is. But, you know, from a material point of view, you read this and you're thinking, huh, he's not really sorry. He still has the same problem, more or less, even with all his philosophizing. But, you know, we do have to remember that he did see the Supreme Lord, and he is on a very elevated level of transcendence. And from that level, things look very different. I mean, things look very, very different. And so it may be really, this is just the plan of God, and it's not that I have some kind of guilt here. Is that all right? But yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? So he does think that he didn't commit an offense. I mean, that's quite clear in his philosophical points here. And he's just decided, I didn't do anything wrong, and therefore this suffering is coming from God. So part of his emotions is accepting that Parvati's not the cause, that God is the cause, this surrendered acceptance. And he takes that everything is a blessing from the Lord. So it's not just acceptance, but it's a kind of gratitude, which you mentioned, you know, that I don't know if he is understanding that this is accelerating his journey back to Godhead, but he's understanding that in some way it's a blessing, and so he feels gratitude, becoming more attached to the Lord through suffering. So he has emotion of greater attachment. So you have the emotions of acceptance, you have emotions of gratitude, you have emotions of increased attachment. Then his philosophical points that I came up with is that this is not karma, that all the whatever the Lord does is good for you. So his gratitude is coming from that philosophical platform, and that he doesn't, and someone who's transcendentally situated doesn't really see a difference between being in the body of a demigod and being in the body of a demon. It basically just doesn't mean anything at all. It's irrelevant, because that's not where their consciousness is. They don't really care. They don't identify with it. It just doesn't mean anything to them. They're aware that the body is like this or that. That's one of the items of surrender. Surrender body, mind, and soul. The surrender of the soul is explained, Lord, you can put me in any species and I don't care, as long as I'm always thinking of you. So it just doesn't matter. I mean, the only thing I can think of that comes close to it, I basically, since I started traveling all the time, all my saris are all exactly the same except for the color of the border. But they're all the same fabric. They're all exactly the same. I mean, I used to do a lot of shopping for devotees, and I learned how to identify, you know, which part of India cloth was made in. Is it from, you know, Orissa? Is it from Kerala? Is it from, where is it made? What kind of fabric is it? What is the weave? What is the dye? You know, I really learned a lot about cloth and how you could tell different, how, you know, the quality. And so I had different sari, you know, I had one sari for this part of India, one from this part of India, and it was quite a difference. You know, and then I had a whole collection of warm, thick saris for the winter and thinner saris for the summer, and twice a year I would switch out my saris. And now that I'm wearing pretty much exactly the same things every day, I'm not generally aware of what I'm wearing. And if you ask me if you ask me at the end of the day, which sari did you wear today? I would say, I don't know. I don't remember. They basically all appear the same to me. So I think it's something like that, where the devotee is just, it just doesn't mean anything. You know, it's irrelevant to them where they're, what situation their body's in. They're just simply not identifying with it. They're aware of it to some extent, but it's just not important. It's just not important. I mean, another analogy you could think of is if you're walking down a busy city street, and you're going somewhere, and so many people are walking past you, and they're having so many conversations, but you notice them, but it's not very important. It doesn't really matter. You have your destination where you're going, and the specifics of the people that are around you are just not relevant. So it's the same with the body, which is hard for us to understand because we're so aware of our body. Also, some of his thoughts were that the demigods, the results given by the demigods, and Parvati is one of the demigods, of course, are always fair and just. That it's like, well, I don't have to be upset because what you've done is fair. Which is interesting, because if he thinks that he's not at fault, why would he think that she was fair?
Yeah.
Maybe from a past life or from something that beyond his own vision. But he's saying, even though I haven't done anything wrong, still whatever the demigods do is fair. This was the point you asked me at lunch, Mahalakshmi.
Yeah.
In 19, neither we nor others cause our happiness and distress. That he's making this point. He says, neither living entity nor others are the cause of material happiness and distress. But because of gross ignorance, the living entity thinks that he and others are the cause. Here we're also...
Which text?
19. Here we're looking again at levels of understanding. We're looking at levels of understanding. Just like you say to a five-year-old child, you must subtract a smaller number from a bigger number. You must do 5 minus 3, you can never do 3 minus 5. But for a 15-year-old, you say you can do 3 minus 5. So for a beginner in spiritual life, we say, the body is material, the soul is spiritual, there's a world of matter, there's a world of spirit, but to the advanced devotee, Sarva Kalami Dham Brahma, everything is spiritual. Matter is infused with the consciousness of God. It's not infused with the consciousness of itself, like a soul, but it's infused with the consciousness of God. So everything is ultimately alive. There's not everything is spiritual means everything is alive. So this is the view of an advanced devotee. But if you say to a beginning devotee, everything is spiritual, they'll say, oh, my smoking is spiritual. And it won't work. You have to say, this is material and this is spiritual. So in a similar way, at one level we say, there's the law of karma. And the living entities act in this way, and they're the cause of their suffering and enjoyment in the world by their karma. On a higher level, we say there is no suffering and enjoyment. It's an illusion. It just doesn't exist. No one's the cause of it. It's just an illusion. It's not there. Again, comparing to a dream or a film. There's, you know, on a movie film, there's suffering and enjoyment in the movie or a book or something like that. But it's not real. It's just not real. Right? Like the bad guys are shooting the good guys in the movie. That's not actually happening. There's no bad guys shooting any good guys. It's not real. So what's the cause of the happiness and distress in a dream or in a movie? It's just an illusion. Nobody's the cause. So that's on another level. I often compare it to playing a game of Monopoly. You all familiar with the game Monopoly?
Yes.
And people get very angry playing Monopoly. I don't know why. That game really seems to bring out a lot of strong emotions. But no, there's nothing really happening. It's a game.
What's the game of Monopoly?
It's where people have fake money, and it's on a board, and you buy and sell properties. And you move around the board, and I haven't played it for a long time. It's basically a modern Vaisha game where you try to make a lot of money and take the money from your opponents. But it's all play money, it's not real money. And the properties you're buying are just little pieces of plastic on a board. But people get very emotionally involved in this. And you can say, well, there's happiness and distress playing this game. And your happiness and distress is caused by how you play the game. But there's no happiness and distress, it's a game. You're not actually earning any money or losing any money. So somebody watching the game would say, this is all just, it's just an illusion. So there's from another point of view that none of this is really happening to the jiva, and therefore there is no cause. Okay, so to whom does the conditioned soul attribute its happiness and distress? Who does the conditioned soul blame? Who does the conditioned soul say is the cause?
Destiny,
what else?
Enemies.
God. Himself, right? I can take some words. Okay, then this idea of the river. You know, I mean, just look how he's talking. What are the heavenly planets? What's happiness and what's distress? They're just waves in the river. None of them have any meaning. He's saying there's just no meaning to it. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, it's just like you're being thrown into a bunch of salt. So, you know, wherever you go, it's just salt. So in illusion, everything is miserable. Of course, to the devotee, everything is happy. And then it's also interesting in 21, when he's talking about the modes, that basically if you're in Sattva-gun, you feel happy, and if you're in Rajagun or Tamagun, you feel distress. So it's not the circumstances, it's what mode you're in. And we experience this. We can be in a situation where it's a beautiful day, we have nice food, we have good friends, we're healthy, but we're upset about something. And so we're unhappy, even in a nice circumstance. Does everyone have this experience? Something's bothering us. And so we're thinking about, he said this, she did this, this happened, what about, you know, we're upset or we're fearful or something. And even though all the circumstances are very nice, we're unhappy because we're in ignorance or passion. And we've had the other experience too, I'm sure, where everything's going wrong and we're happy. Has you all had this experience? Yeah. You know, everything's going wrong. Nothing's going right. People didn't show up on time and nothing's finished and there's nothing good to eat and whatever. You know, any of your plans is just not working, but you're just happy. It's like, whatever. It's okay. So our happiness and distress is coming from what, if we're in goodness, we're happy, and if we're in passion, ignorance, we're not happy. So he's making that point too. And then in 21, the liberated people, they don't have this happiness and distress. They just don't experience it. They just simply don't experience this at all. It has just nothing to do with them. You know, it's something that they're not identifying with. You know, obviously liberated persons are not just blank. They're not just like a stone. They're experiencing spiritual happiness, but the material happiness and distress has no meaning to them. So I had some experience of this in childbirth when I had read where Prabhupada said that even Stalin had a surgical operation without anesthesia, and that therefore a Krishna conscious person can put their mind in such a way that there's no pain. So I decided I was going to do that, and I did that when I was in labor and childbirth with my second child. I just meditated on the belt of Govinda at the New York temple, the deity there, this belt of big beads. And I could feel what my body was doing, but it was not, I did not experience it as pain at all, not even one slightly. I was just aware of it. It was just kind of interesting. It was, oh, look at that. Oh, that's interesting. But it wasn't even my main, it was again like you're walking down the street and you have something that you're fixated on, and maybe somebody walks past you that's interesting. And, oh, it's an interesting person. But you don't give it much attention. It's just not where you're putting your attention. And there were really, the concept of material happiness and distress was just not there. It just wasn't there at all. So the liberated souls are living in that kind of state where the idea of happiness and distress in this world, it doesn't have any meaning to them. And then his mood that the Supreme Lord is equal and neutral, that he doesn't have any friends or enemies, or happiness and distress. And as was said, somebody was saying that just like, you know, the Lord is like that, I am also like that. Now, 23 is a particular interest, so let's turn to 23. And here, that the Lord creates pious and impious activities, but he's not responsible for the happiness and distress that we get. So here Prabhupada gives some analogies. What are the analogies Prabhupada gives? He gives two analogies.
Government.
Yes, government and?
A judge.
Well, the judge is part of the government.
The lilies open up and then the bumblebees.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
The lilies open and close because of the sunshine. Yeah.
So God is compared, in the first one, God is compared to a? Everybody, God is compared to a?
Judge.
A judge. Is the judge responsible for the happiness and distress of the criminals?
No.
No. But does the judge give the sentence for the criminals?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, the second one, God is compared to the?
Lilies.
No.
Seas.
No. The second one, God is compared to the?
Sunshine.
Thank you. We first think and read. The second one, God is compared to the?
Sunshine.
Everybody, God is compared to the?
Sunshine.
Sun. And the sun gives, the sun causes what to happen?
Lilies open.
The lilies to open, and who gets happy?
The bees.
The bees. And when the sun goes down, what happens?
The lilies close.
Lilies close. Who suffers?
The bees.
The bees.
Stay inside.
Or they can't get any. Either they get stuck inside, or there's no more food. Like you go to a restaurant after it closes, and there's no more food. Right? You knock on the door of Govinda's with the MBT. Sorry, we're closed. So the sun does that. The sun has the food for the bees. Okay, food time. Okay, restaurant closed. Is the sun responsible for the happiness of the bees? Is the sun responsible for the happiness of the bees?
No.
No. But is it because of the sun that the bees can eat or not eat?
Yes.
Okay, so we have one last thing that we're going to do here. So, okay, can you get into different groups than you've gotten in before? And if these two ladies can work, not with each other, but with other people. And we need five groups. So some groups of two, some groups of threes, but if you guys can work with, maybe you guys work with each other instead of the same three people working with the same three people. And okay, each group pick one. Pick one, whatever you want. Alright. So you're going to argue that whatever you have on your paper is the source of the problem. That this was the cause of the cursing of Chitraketu. Okay? So you need to figure out an argument as to why what's on your paper is... Everyone have a paper?
Yeah.
Yes? Then we need another group there. So you need to have three groups of guys if you've got two papers. No, there's one, two, three, four, five groups. So
instead of having
three, you have two groups. We need three groups of men. Okay, there you go. So I want you to take 5 minutes to prepare your arguments, and you want to try to win. Okay, why this is the cause of Chitraketu's becoming a demon. This is the cause of Chitraketu's becoming a demon. So I want you to present a good argument. Okay. Now, the great mystery, who is the cause of the cursing of Chitraketu. We will now hear all of the arguments and decide who is the actual cause of the cursing of Chitraketu. Who would like to present their case first to the jury? All right. Yes. So who do you say is the cause of Chitraketu's?
Parvati's decision and demigods being silent is the cause for Chitraketu.
Why is Parvati's decision the cause?
Yeah, if she would have just corrected him, curse is this very big thing. And if she calls him as a son, but we feel that she didn't act, saying she didn't act as a mother and to the as a son, because you didn't curse your son. You were correct your son. So and the demigods, they were sitting there and they were silent all the time, approving that the part whatever Parvati is doing is right, even to him what she
So it was her bad decision that was responsible.
And also the others' bad decisions.
So the demigods in general.
Yes.
Okay. Who else would like to present their view? Who wants to be next? Yes.
Our view is karma.
Karma. Okay, why is that?
That the law of nature says in every action there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So presently, Chitraketu criticized Vasudeva.
Presently, Chitraketu?
Yeah, we don't know his past, he has done, but presently, he criticized Vasudeva in the presence of all the sages. So, Parvati saw that this is a bad action, so that was punished.
So, he's just getting a bad reaction for something in the past? Okay, thank you.
We agree.
Well, who wants to present next? Yes.
So we present that Shiva and Parvati's behavior are the cause of Chitraketu ending as a demon, because of the fact that Shiva had his wife on the top in his lap in front of a big assembly of horrible personalities, and he could have corrected Chitraketu, and he didn't. He just simply smiled, so that opened him to behave the way he did.
Okay, so you're saying with Shiva's bad behavior,
yes,
that he and Parvati were acting this way in front of everybody.
Shiva could have corrected him.
And that Shiva was just silent. Okay.
No.
What do you guys say?
We don't agree
to any of this. Who do you say is responsible?
We say the Supreme Lord is the cause, because everything happens by the will of the Lord. And the Lord arranged for the curse because Chitraketu is proud of his spirituality. The Lord arranged for it to speed up his return back home. And he's in charge of everything, so he allowed it to happen. And the force of karma is just the Supreme Lord anyway. The curse was under the material modes, and the Lord is in charge of them. And he is Ishvara, he's the Supreme Controller. And the Lord is also the benefactor of all living beings. So it must have been good anyway.
Oh boy, okay. All right. Do we have any other opinions here?
Yes. Objection.
You have an objection.
So what is your point? Objection.
Yes. Well, we wish to prove our point that Chitraketu alone is responsible.
Who is responsible?
Chitraketu,
the accused.
The defendant. Because you have to prove it two ways. One is that giving directly the reasons why Chitrakepu is responsible, and also by disproving that why others are wrong. So first is that his own past deeds are responsible.
And then he said, come on.
Yes, but he did those something wrong in his past life, so that is why he is responsible. And the second is that he was so puffed up with pride that he thought he can demonstrate or rectify such as the highest Vaishnava, topmost Vaishnava, Lord Shiva. And he laughed at him and criticized him. He had no authority. So to do it, so he alone is responsible for the class.
But I object. If Mother Parvati is not there, which is the point, he would have got cursed or not.
Okay. So
I
take
it. Saying that money was there, I'm not responsible. That's why I took the
Okay, I'd like each of you on your own, please write a few sentences, not more than four, of your own conclusion. What is your own personal actual conclusion? Your real actual conclusion as to what was the cause of Chitraketu's curse. Yes, do that right now. Because just for yourself, just your own actual opinion. What was the cause? Just a few sentences, 3 to 5 sentences. And explain it. So explain why you feel, you don't have to share this with anyone, this is just for yourself. Tomorrow morning, we'll be finishing this particular pastime, and we'll be finishing it with a really in-depth look at the qualities of a devotee that allow that devotee to be as happy and equipoised as Chitraketu was in this pretty horrible situation. And what allows the devotees to be detached from great difficulty. So I think that will be useful, yes? Okay, so we have 5 more minutes. If anyone has any questions or discussion so far, because we haven't had a lot of time for, we haven't had any time for just a general open, so we have just 5 minutes now for like a general open discussion on anything that we've discussed so far since Sunday that has not been brought up that anybody would like to bring up. Yes?
Yeah. In the beginning, you were explaining about body language.
Yes.
Here in India, when somebody wants to say yes or no, they just shift.
They do this, for instance. Yes.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's actually, you can see a lot of funny videos about this. People making jokes about this funny thing that can mean yes, no, maybe. It can mean all kinds of whatever they want it to mean. the Indian head waggle. I don't know if any other culture does that quite yet.
Indians understand. Like
they understand. Yeah.
Which one is no one, which is yes.
They're experts. And the rest of us, we just kind of look and think, I don't know what you said. Okay, I will do it too. Yeah.
Sometimes I'll be distributing books. I'll get some book terms to just be thinking like this. I'll have to think, what do you mean?
Anybody else?
I have something.
Yes.
That caught my attention. About that, Chitraketu was, he had learned the lesson after his child died and came back to life. And now he is there with all the ladies. No, but he was chanting and he was engaging all his energy on that, his service was being with women because he had so many wives previously. So that was his service, and it says in the verse that he was perfect.
Yes.
He was chanting according to his situation. So it's an observation that because this happens often with the Grihasthas, no? That they are criticized, or women, or children, or that sometimes we criticize devotees, but because we have some so-called standard for devotee, the image of a devotee. But Grihasthas, who are engaged in earning money and maintaining the family, they may be criticized, but they are doing their dharma.
Well, not only was Chitraketu doing his dharma, but Chitraketu was actually, I mean, in the beginning, with his kingdom, he was much more into his dharma. That, you know, I need to run the kingdom, and I need to produce a heir for the succession of the kingdom.
Okay.
But actually, Chitraketu really messed up with his dharma as a king.
Yes.
He really messed it up. I mean, he took on way too many wives, way more than he could take care of. And he didn't take care of them properly at all. He didn't even take care of his own family properly. You know, when his son was born, he should have taken care of the other women too, not just the mother of the child. And the queen wasn't quit to duty. She didn't take care of her sister wives and make sure that they were happy. The other women, they were just envious instead of being, you know, a mood of servants of Prithaduti and Chitraketu and being happy that their husband finally got an heir to the throne. They just became envious. Chitraketu wasn't thinking properly of the citizens. I mean, the whole idea of having a child was to provide an heir for the throne and continuation of the care for the country. But he wasn't taking proper care of his country either by being so absorbed in his family life and just, you know, taking care of all of these wives. He couldn't properly run the kingdom. There's no way he could have done it. So he really messed up. Yes. with his dharma. But when he was given here to be the head of these Vidyadharas, that wasn't just dharma, that was actually his seva.
His seva.
And I think for, you know, it's definitely an issue in our Hare Krishna movement that we're trying to provide, trying to create a society, and yet we focus so much on renunciation. Because you're never going to create a society just of renunciates. Then it would be the International Monastery for Krishna Consciousness. You know, it's just, that's not a society. You're not going to take over the world like that. I mean, there was one religion, the Shakers, that they didn't allow marriage. Everybody had to be celibate. They didn't allow marriage. And they didn't last. The religion didn't last. What? Don't they have married people? They're all brahmacharis. But there's never been a religion that's succeeded without children. It just hasn't happened. And you're not going to have a whole society for the whole world where nobody gets married and nobody has a career and nobody has a home. And that, then there'd be no varnashram. There'd be no, without grihasthas, there's no varna. Varna is career. So students, retired, and dead people don't have careers. So there would be no careers. And, you know, there you wouldn't have all of the ashram. So we wouldn't really have a society. Yeah, it's a... thinking like that is a very short-sighted way of thinking about our mission. It's not a holistic way of looking at our mission. Anyone else a comment or question?
Just in that context, if suppose we wanted to be full-time dedicated to ISKCON, does it mean that we don't have a career?
That you don't have a career? You can have a career within ISKCON. There aren't that many careers available within ISKCON. So you have a very, if you want to work full time for ISKCON, there's a really limited number of career opportunities. There's a few brahminical careers and a few shudra careers. It's kind of hard to have a vaishya career for ISKCON, working under the ISKCON management, and it's very difficult to have a Kshatriya career working under ISKCON. ISKCON is primarily a Brahminical institution. And it's basically the legal ISKCON entity is mostly an institution for worship and education. It's not, the ISKCON institution itself is not a full society.
Although we have the S of society.
Yes, but we're trying to establish a society. But as far as like being under the GBC and being, you know, something that's legally ISKCON property and under the authority of the GBC and run as the legal entity ISKCON, the number of careers available is very small. And keep in mind that ISKCON's mission to create a Krishna conscious society is not just what's going to be under the GBC. I don't think the GBC is going to run the world. You can ask them if they want to do that, but I've asked them and they all say no. So every GBC member I've asked, do you want to run the world? They all say no. So I don't think that the GBC want to run the Indian government and the Pakistani government and the Turkish government. And it doesn't think that's their interest. So part of our mission is to make the whole world Krishna conscious, which means that we need to have people who have careers outside of the legal entity. They're still ISKCON members and they're still working fully for ISKCON's mission, but they're doing that within careers in the world. And Prabhupada very much encouraged that from the beginning. So one can work fully for ISKCON's mission, either legally under the auspices of the GBC on ISKCON property, or one can do it also doing something outside of that. It depends on what your nature is. Yes?
I was not confirmed on this. Someone told me, I asked, so said, according to the place circumstances, if ISKCON there, a lot of services are there, according to their understanding level and qualifications. But if something is not authorized by the GBC or by the Shastra or by the Srila Prabhupada, they should not try to do it forcefully, like in America or different other parts of Europe, their society allows women can be worshipped as pujari services or different other services. But in India, this country, a lot of services are not allowed for women. But if they will try to do it forcefully, then there will be problems. So they can do at home and as a legal professional services like as accountant or teacher, this type of services.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always some adjustment that has to be made according to the time, place, and circumstance. Whether we're talking about what the legal official entity of ISKCON does, or whether we're talking about what we're going to do in the society in general. That's one of the 14 principles of knowledge, is that you know time, place, and circumstance, and you act accordingly.
Yes.
It's one of Krishna's qualities. So, you know, how exactly we spread Krishna consciousness in China is not going to be quite the same as how we're going to spread Krishna consciousness in Ghana. I mean, there is some difference, and that has to be there. And even there's some difference, frankly, in how we apply some of the instructions from Prabhupada and Acharyas and the Bhagavatam. That again has to be there. That's always the case. Anybody else have anything that they want to discuss? Questions? Anything? Okay, so we will see you tomorrow morning, and we're all going to learn how to become as happy and detached and equipoised as Chitraketu. Then you're not, and you don't need it. I already told you that. Krishna arranges that we hear what we need to hear, when we need to hear it, how we need to hear it. Thank you very much. I hope you've been having fun.